hard time getting through the last 20 years in an hour. In fact, I think we depends on what you're interested in, what aspect of the history. But I'll start out, and then maybe I'll pause and see if you have some specific questions on certain aspects of history that you're curious about. I think most of you are familiar with the early beginnings when Wes Pree broke the initial letters up, so we won't dwell on that a great deal. He wrote to the Howe Sound Company in 1957, 58, and 59, and finally in 1960, the gift more or less came into the hands of the church, first through LBI as a, more or less as a transferring organization. LBI never did have any intention of keeping Holden, realizing that it was much too big a project for them to be involved with at that time. But because Holden was located on Forest Service property, we leased from the Forest Service here, and it had to be, the Forest Service wouldn't allow an organization that wasn't financially capable of handling a project this size, otherwise they just end up with the problem in another couple of years. So LBI accepted the gift initially, and then in February of 1961, the Forest Service issued a special use permit, which allowed Holden Village Incorporated to exist on this parcel of federal property. So really the official, or one of the official histories or starting points of Holden would be at that point when the Forest Service issued the special use permit, and that was in February of 1961. It was incorporated also in that winter or prior to February, and became then Holden Village Incorporated, a nonprofit corporation in the state of Washington, which it remains. The first work parties moved into the village then in June of 1961. Some of you may know some, at that time, what were called the forerunners. In the early days of the village, instead of having, of course, this many people and this many workers here, there were work camps that were sponsored by the three major Lutheran groups in America, the Missouri Synod, the Lutheran Church in America, and the American Lutheran Church. And what they did, Holden was really set up as a part of the youth offices of those three churches. It, again, to regress a bit, this facility came into being, but nobody knew what to do with it. It was one of these projects, I guess, that isn't so unusual, but generally somebody gets an idea for a concept for a program, or finds a need that needs a facility, and then people go out and look for a facility or for a piece of real estate to build a facility on. Well, in this case, when Wes contacted the Howe Sound Company, which then resulted in the eventual gift to Holden Village, first of all, nobody in the church knew that he was writing the letters. Secondly, Wes didn't really have, you know, any, you know, master plan of what Holden would be. This property, or the Holden Village, was actually offered to the American Lutheran Church North Pacific District at one time, and they turned it down, again, thinking that, or feeling that it was much too big a project for them to do, and figuring that because of its location, because of the remoteness, because of the size of the facility, it was just something beyond like one district of the church to be involved with. So it eventually came into the hands of the youth offices of the three major Lutheran groups, and it was primarily their interest to have Holden Village become a young adult center. I think all through the history of the church, that at least the history that I'm familiar with, that it's been a problem of how to program for the young adult. The Luther League in years gone past was very active for the group up to 16 years old. But then from 16 to 21, 25, and there was a very difficult age group for the church to program. And so that they were looking for some facility that might be a focal point for the young adult ministry within the church. And Holden happened to come at that point, and so they all said, you know, here it is. It's in the wilderness, it'll attract the young adult, and you know, this will be our solution for the young adult ministry. So the representatives on the initial board that controlled Holden Village were first of all the youth directors of the three major Lutheran churches, and then others were involved primarily because of their interest in either youth work or because they had been involved in the initial finding of the village as such. Still at that time, there was no master plan or overall concept of what type of programming was going to be involved. In 1961, when the first workers came up here, Dr. Wilton Bergstrand, who some of you may either know or have heard of, who was the youth director of the Lutheran Church in America for many years, 25 years, he came up as one of the initial teaching staff or faculty. And also, Wilton Bergstrand was offered the first directorship of of the village, and after about a year of considering it, then turned it back. So that in those initial years, a fellow by the name of Gil Berg, who some of you also may know from the Seattle area, he was nearing retirement age, had a very successful oil distributor business over in Seattle, had done a lot of volunteer work, was a member of the Lutheran Free Church, which just at that point in church history was also merging with the American Lutheran Church. And Gil took a real liking to this project. Gil was also on the board, I think the chairman of the board of LBI at that time. And so Gil Berg became the first director and business manager on a volunteer basis between 1961 and 1963. So for those two or three summers, Gil was really the only administrative personnel that was involved with the village, and he was doing it on a volunteer basis. Gil also signed the only loan that the village has ever had, or actually he paid for it, so the village, I think we can still say, has never had to borrow any money for this entire operation. The old two-ton international truck, which faithfully makes its way back and forth on the road, is needing replacement very badly, but still runs well, so we keep it. But that was the first vehicle that the village owned. That was purchased new in 1961, and Gil signed the note with the international company in Seattle to purchase that. So then in 61, when the work campers started up, such as the Forerunners that I mentioned before, they came in for the first time on June 15th, 1961. They had their 20th anniversary last year, and I think that five or six of them out of the group of 20 or so came back for the 20th anniversary, also coming into the village on June 15th of 1981 to come in on the same day to make it historically significant. And many of those people from the early years, of course, come back, but not all of them were able to come back at just that particular instant. For the first couple years then, the village was really operated by work camp groups chosen by the youth offices. If you were interested at that time in working at Holden, you would send your application into St. Louis or Minneapolis, or at that time Philadelphia, I guess it still is Philadelphia, and say that you're interested in a work camp project at Holden Village, and then they would make the selections. They would send the list out here of who was due on June 1st, July 1st, or August 1st, and then there were three work camps. It worked out nice with the three major Lutheran groups, 3 months during the summer when we were trying to operate. By the summer of 1964, it became harder and harder for the youth offices to come up with enough people to work up here. Not that people weren't interested, but this was only one of the projects that the youth offices were involved with. And even though the village wasn't very big at that time from an operation standpoint, we still needed to know that there were going to be a certain number of workers showing up at a certain time so we could get the work done. So starting in 1964, then we took over the staffing of the village from the youth offices. And then from that point on, Holden has been responsible for selecting the staff, coming up with the right numbers, and scheduling them in. In those years, like in 1963, I was on the volunteer staff from June until September, and there were a total of 5 of us that were on the staff the entire summer, compared with, I think it's 100 or 110 right now. And then each month, approximately 30 young adults would come in to be a part of the staff on the month basis. Right after Labor Day, the village essentially closed down. When the last bus went down the hill on September 6th, or whenever Labor Day is, that was it. There might be 5 people left in the village. And essentially, then the village was closed until the next spring in middle of May. Well, in 66 is when we made the decision to try to keep the village open in the wintertime. Of course, the mine had operated here, so we knew it wasn't any, great pioneering effort on our part to be here. People had been here for 20 years in the wintertime and survived rather well and liked it. So the only question that we had was, first of all, was it financially worth it to be up here in the wintertime, realizing that, it would take many years for any activity in the winter to build up to the point where it might support itself. Secondly, would it be fair for the village to maintain people at the village, because there is naturally extra dangers involved in being this remote, being cut off possibly by avalanche. The boat only runs 3 times a week in the wintertime. No communications out of the village, so that there were some extra dangers involved in the winter operation. So that first winter, again, there had been people here. Reuben Thompson, who now is in Minneapolis and I think in a nursing home back in Minneapolis, was the first caretaker of the village and came up here in May of 1961, and then spent the winters of 1961 and 62 all by himself up here. And a couple years later, the board, really were concerned that they had even allowed that to take place, because naturally for one person is more dangerous than for several. We had no transportation at that time, so once a week he would ski or snowshoe down to the lake to pick up his mail, and he would send out Christmas cards at Christmas, so everybody knew he was okay. And in May the roads opened and we came up and knew that he was still here, and he had a faithful dog named Bugger, little black cocker spaniel. And the village, of course, supplied food, but it was mainly food that was brought in at the beginning of the season and lasted the winter. Maybe a few fresh things were brought in by the boat. But then in 1960, the winter of 63, then one of his nephews and another person who was a mechanic at that time lived up here. So by 1963, there were 3 people living here, and also in 64. And that's when we started this building. A lot of the original interior of this building was done in the wintertime of starting in the winter of 1964. And then in the winter of 1966 is when we decided to open the village throughout the year, staying up here in the winter. And then it was Judy, my wife, and myself, and one other person that were here the first winter, the entire winter. And that in August of that year, we purchased the first snowmobile. It was a Swedish snow track with a VW engine as a power. So we did have transportation in and out, and it, by that time it was almost luxury, because we had the hydro plant going year round, and so we had electricity, and we had Chalet 1 was the only building that was open out of the entire village. All of us lived in Chalet 1, all 3 of us, and Judy did all the cooking, and which is the way it's supposed to be, I think, isn't it? And then the two of us males did the dishes, and I guess that's the way it's supposed to be also. But at that time, we moved the village from Seattle over here, so that since 1966, then the administrative duties have been concentrated here at the village, and from 66 on, we've always had the office here. All the registrations, all the business aspects have been handled right out of the village. Did you have some questions on maybe those first couple of years? Of course, if you don't know anything about it, it's hard to ask questions.
Did the Sound Company rig up the hydroelectric plant, or did the church do this?
No, the House Sound Company had a power line that operated, or that came up lake, and came up from Manson. At the time it was put in by Washington Water Power, and then later the Chelan County PUD bought out Washington Water Power, and then took over the lines. But those lines provided power for the mine during the entire mine history. Before the mine opened, they had wanted to put in a hydroelectric plant off of Domke Lake. If you came up, well, all of you came up the lake, and probably the boat pointed out Domke Falls. Well, Domke Lake is the largest mountain lake in this area. I don't recall how many acres, but it's about a mile long. And the mine had a plan to divert some water out of Railroad Creek at about the 2,100 foot level, which is the level of Domke Lake, and have a flume that would go from Railroad Creek into Domke to supplement the water in Domke Lake, primarily for the winter. And then the hydroelectric plant was going to be someplace on the outlet of Domke Lake on the falls, and they would have had a large enough hydro plant to provide all the electricity for the mine. And they did considerable engineering work on that, and had enough encouragement to go ahead with it. But then when the final plans were drawn up, both the Game Department and the Forest Service turned them down as far as going ahead with the project. And as we've been told, that almost was a significant factor for the mine company, that they almost decided not to continue on with the operation, but had enough encouragement as far as the ore body so that they decided to go ahead with the extra cost of putting in the lines. Now, maybe some of you met him, and I can't remember his name. He just left yesterday, who was the electrical engineer, I think, with Washington Water Power at the time when they put in the lines, and was up here in 1937 when they threw the switch on with the first electricity coming into the village.
How did you say the Lutherans first discovered this? Well, they knew it was here.
Well, Wes Preeb, who is the only person that has ever received a PhD here in the village, stands for pool hall director.
That's my favorite spot.
Yeah.
He
was doing some work in Alaska at the time, and just read it in the paper that Howe Sound Mining Company was closing down the Chelan division, and he decided to write a letter and see once if it wouldn't be available for the church. He'd never been here. He'd just to know Wes, if you get talking with him, you'll also.
Yeah, he's nice.
He's a couple years later, when I got acquainted with him, it made sense that he would do such a thing as this, because a couple years later he also bid on a battleship that was that was moored in Lake Union in Seattle, and saw that it was up for sale and thought that, you know, it might be usable. He missed out because he only bid a dollar, and I think somebody got it for $500,000 or something like that. It was close, but
a good price on this?
No, it was an outright gift. It was an outright gift.
There was
not even a dollar exchange. Some people have thought that there was a dollar exchange for tax reasons, but the information that I've seen indicated that they apparently had enough losses that they didn't even use this as a tax write-off at that point as far as the gift. They tried to sell it for a number of years and had it for sale for $200,000, and initially offered it to Wes for $100,000, since it was a church organization that was interested in it. But it is one of the, I think, miraculous things, because I saw clippings from the Seattle paper that indicated that, in fact, the firemen, the Seattle City Fire Department, had announced in the Seattle paper that they were involved with a fundraising drive for an organization that was trying to purchase Holden Village, or Holden at that time it was called, and that they wanted to make another, you know, a village like Father Flanagan's village in Omaha, and that they had announced that they were on this fundraising drive to come up with a down payment to make the purchase. And then just a couple months later, there was an announcement in the Seattle paper that a recreational development group had put the down payment down on this property, and they apologized to the group that was trying to create a Father Flanagan-style village here. But they said that they had the down payment, and they had big plans for a large recreational skiing. I think they even at that time, and I don't remember when the laws changed in the state of Washington, I think they were interested in having gambling up here and more or less a plush resort. And why I never did hear or read anything why that fell through. There was also the Boy Scouts of America in the Northwest that I understand had organized effort to try to come up with funds to purchase this. And why all of those seem to fall through, and here Wes Preeb writing, you know, three letters and asking him for nothing, and nobody else in the church realizing that. Well, that's right. Yeah,
wow.
That's.
But God it's. God stepped in and plumbed the Luther's cabin.
Well, we hope that we've shared it with everybody so that everybody can enjoy it. But it is part of the, you know, interesting history of how it came about. Going back to the question on the hydro plant in 1960. 1962, Holden had a study done by the PUD, Chelan County PUD, on how much it would cost to activate the lines again, because that obviously was the first thing that we wanted to check out, and it would have cost about $40,000 to activate the lines. And then all the electricity, even in the mine days, was metered in Chelan, and this engineer that was here said that they figured on about a 15% loss coming up the valley, the 55 miles of lines. But we would have also been responsible for either all or a high percentage of the maintenance of the lines, which would have been very difficult on a year-round basis. And then, of course, everybody knows what's happened to electrical rates. And even in Stehekin now, at the head of the lake, PUD is the responsibility up there. And I think right now they're paying, I think, about 5 cents a kilowatt. And they've indicated at some point in history it will probably have to be up towards 25 cents per kilowatt in order to, you know, break even up there. Now, I think according to PUD, they have, that's one of the aspects of the PUD, that they equalize their rates. They don't charge the Stehekin and just what it costs to produce it up there, but everybody shares that cost. But even at that, we're producing about a, or consuming about a million kilowatts of electricity, kilowatt hours of electricity a year. So that even at 5 cents a kilowatt, we'd be talking about $50,000 in extra cost in our budget. And that's per year. And we put the whole hydro plant in between 1963 and 1964 for $39,000. And now we're producing 360 kilowatts of power during the summertime. Or about a million kilowatt hours a year. In 1966, then, we built a new diversion dam higher on Railroad Creek because we were using the original diversion dam that the mine put in for their domestic supply, and there was only about a, let's see, what was it, a 400-foot head on the lower diversion dam, so we were only getting like 50-60% of the power out of the turbines that we could realize. So in 1966 we put in a new diversion dam, and now we operate off of that, and it's a 634-foot head, so we can get the maximum. We have two 200 kilowatt units, and because of the pipe limitation, that we can only get about 360 kilowatts out of the two units when we have sufficient water in the summer. Let's see, that project, yes?
Where is the diversion dam?
Diversion dam is, from down here you can see the water tank of the village. It's a 75,000 gallon domestic supply, and direct, there's a road that leads directly up from that. And
that's diverted from Railroad Creek.
Yeah, it's diverted from Railroad Creek. Yeah. And during the wintertime, the volume of water drops considerably, and so we have to rely in the village primarily on wood and oil. And now we're just in the process, and hopefully by the end of the month when the trustees meet, that they'll come up with a decision on a new hydro plant that would be down on Railroad Creek and would produce about an additional 300 kilowatts of power, primarily for winter use, but then would also be available for us in the summer. And if we would go ahead with that project, then we could do away entirely with all of our oil consumption and our wood consumption. And that's, we hope that we might be able to do that project, but it's of course very expensive. The difference between the two projects is that in when we did this one, we were very fortunate that the rancher in eastern Washington, after we found the units, paid for them. And all of that equipment, the two generators, the two turbines, the governors, some of the switching gear, he paid a total of $1,500 for. That was in the era when nobody was interested in hydro plants. It had been sitting idle for 20 years. And when we found it, some of the equipment, you know, some of the windings had been eaten by rodents or mice, and a little bit of the equipment had been lost, the governor, the linkage, and so forth, but it was all repairable and was, you know, basically sound. But the equipment is very old. It was made in the prior to 1920, and yet it probably has another 40 years or more life to it, and that's the beauty about hydropower. So. That project then went in that era from about 1962 and 63 up to 67 when we finished the upper diversion dam, and then have had electricity in the village ever since. In the 1961 to 1964, before we had the hydro plant, we had a diesel electric plant, which we still use as standby, and you'll pass it if you walk down towards the vehicle bridge. And because of even the oil cost at that time, which was, I think, a whopping 17 or 18 cents a gallon, that we didn't feel that we could afford to have the diesel plant going 24 hours a day for electricity, so we'd always turn it off at 10:30 at night, and Reuben or whoever was here at that point would get up at 5:30 and turn on the electricity so the kitchen could start cooking. And there was that period of time when there was no electricity in the village. And people enjoyed it so much because, you know, when it's totally dark in the village on a clear night, the stars are, you know, just out of this world. Even now they are. But people tended to enjoy it. Seemed like, you know, more conversations took place at 10:30 to, you know, midnight when there was no electricity. And there was a serious resolution in the board of directors wondering if it isn't possible to, even though we had the hydro plant and it wasn't costing us that much to operate, if we couldn't turn the electricity off at 10:30 at night and possibly rewire the village so the compressors could, you know, have electricity but all the lights go off. And partially because of the insurance agent stepped in and said that they were lenient in the years when we didn't have electricity at night, knowing that we were going to have it 24 hours a day at some point, but they felt that the safety factor was just too much of a risk and advised us to have electricity on 24 hours a day. In the early years, like in 1961, about 500 people came to the village, and even that was, you know, a lot for the years when there was very little publicity. A lot of them were like the work campers that came in. Everybody that came at that point, they would come for shorter periods of time, like one or two nights. They would pay their registration fee, and then they would also work. There was really no differentiation, in a sense, between the staff and the guests. It was just sort of understood, and I think everybody that came up here came up really with the excitement of seeing, you know, a new project develop, and it was just sort of a natural that they would rake the lawns or, you know, do something along that line to help the village get started. In 1962, as you remember, the World's Fair took place in Seattle. And this, in a sense, was really a boon for the village because a lot of Lutherans live in the Midwest, and there was publicity, and they also have a lot of relatives living in Seattle. And so that a lot of people reading about the village and the excitement, you know, of what the village might become or did become, you know, stopped through here on their way to the World's Fair. And so that already by 1962, the registrations had gone up to about 1,600 people. Again, for basically one or two nights. And then in 1963, it went up to, I think, around 2,000. And then each year after that, it's just progressively gone up to where we really hit a plateau of about 5,000, or about 5 years ago, at about 5,000 or 5,500 people. And the natural limitations are, of course, the physical size of the village, the transportation coming up the road. Those two things really limited us, and then also vacations. Our busy time is basically the same time that's busy for any summer resort or activity, because that's when people are available to travel or do travel. So from mid-June until mid-September is our busy season, and even though we're open year-round, we just don't get that many registrations through the off-season. It's not promoted a great deal, but it's always open and always available, so that anytime you want to come to the village, it is available for you to come within the limitations that we have. And this in itself, I think, has been a significant thing over the history of the village, and I think differentiates it from what many people know of as a Bible camp or a summer camp, that we inherited a real community that had been, you know, life and blood for people for 20 years. People lived year-round here. They grew families here. Some people died here, and so it was an actual community that had more than just a summer experience. And I think that even is significant in the total effect of the village, is that now, also since 66, it's been a year-round community. And one of the things that we've always hoped that people understand is that it is a Christian community that is also here to help and to serve and to be available in time of need. So that, and over the years, this has not been played up a lot in promotion, but somebody suffering a loss in the family or going through bereavement or whatever it might be, that we get a lot of people that come up here on really the spur of the moment or in need of just a place to get away. And also that people have told us that just knowing that the village is here to come to if they need has been a significant thing. And some people that have been recovering alcoholics that have been here have said that they may never return, but they always know that if they need the village, that they can get on the boat, come up here, and they know that there's a community here that they can be involved with and worship with. Yes?
How did it happen that
when you mentioned Bible camp, it reminded me that at one point there were a number of youth groups that would come here as a group. And now I'd heard somewhere recently that really this isn't a Bible camp for kids and so on. How did you change that?
Well,
I'm not arguing with it, I'm just wondering what was
the evolution. It's a good point. And I think there are a number of groups that were significant in the beginnings of the village. And youth groups were one of them. Another group that some of you may have heard of is the CFO, the Camp Farthest Out. That's an international religious family camping group. And they also came up here in those early years for 4 or 5 years. And also another group that came up was the United States Air Force Spiritual Life Conference. And they brought like 300, 350 Air Force personnel up here for a week's conference. Well, all of these things, including youth groups, was really not what the village, in a sense, had in mind. But because very few other people were coming, that, you know, if you're empty, you might as well at least take people that want to come. To come. And the village has always been very careful, first of all, not to compete with the congregation. That I think right from the beginning that the village has said that we're here to serve the congregation and that we're here to serve the pastors within the congregation. We're not here to, you know, pull your people out into a super congregation that's, you know, where we maintain an alumni society. And I think if you've been around the village over a period of years, you know that even the mailings are very minimal out of the village. Sometimes, well, now it's pretty much stable at two, but sometimes it was one, sometimes we wouldn't even make that, and now it's pretty much stabilized at two, a fall mailing and a spring mailing. So that the village has never attempted to form a strong alumni group. That's not the purpose of the village. But the youth groups, the CFO, the Air Force, some other groups that came and used the village as a conference ground, I think were significant financially for the village. And it's not that we didn't want them here, it's that in order to survive, we said, yeah, come and join us and enjoy the village. But at some point, when enough other people are coming, then, you know, realize that what the purpose of the village is a retreat center, an adult retreat center. And it's not a criticism of youth, it's just, I think, a given factor that, and for a while this was happening, where more youth were coming up here, and certain weeks were known as youth weeks, then fewer adults would come. Again, it's not a criticism of youth, but youth do not go to bed as early as adults. They generally have more energy to run around and make noise, and this is part of being a youth, and the village was not trying to change this. But it was also realized that when you have adults that are coming up to be a part of a retreat experience, they do appreciate a good night's sleep. And so in a sense, the two are not compatible. So that's one reason why as more and more people came to the village to make use of the village in its original intent, or in its intent that it came about as after 1963, then the decision was made to downplay the youth. But hopefully it was done in such a way that it was done with appreciation, not with, you know, saying, you know, you've ruined our experience so you can't come. But, you know, thanks for helping make the village possible over these years. But now we have enough adults and this is what the village is. There are Bible camps that are specifically for youth. Again, we didn't want to compete with the Bible camp. And yet this was the only thing that the church really knew. And it was very difficult in those early years to promote the village. Most people would say, oh, it's something like a Bible camp, but different. And there was just no comparison, and so it always got, you know, referred to as a Bible camp, but something different. And again, there's no criticism of the Bible camp, but the village was just a different programming approach. It was a retreat ministry that was involved in primarily adult programming. The children's program that we have, known as Narnia, is here primarily because we're also interested in having young families here that have children, and if they have to take care of their children, then they can't get the program. So the Narnia program is really to accommodate the retreat program rather than trying to set up a separate program in the village. For a long time, the village really hesitated even having a young adult program, or, you know, like for teenagers that are here. We tried to make the point that we accept you as adults. Please accept the adult village program and participate in it. And finally, about 3 years ago, we just sort of gave up on that and said, okay, we realize that the young adults or youth 16, 14, 15, 16, 17 hesitate to come with their parents to a lecture and discuss. And so that the last several years now, we have had people specifically working with teens. And it's not a real obvious program in the village, but I think a very good program in the village, and one that takes care of that sort of in-between age that really doesn't, I guess, feel comfortable yet in coming to the adult programming. Not that they're not capable of it, it's just that they don't feel comfortable. So some other questions that I'm not sure exactly where we are in the history. So.
Where's the cemetery? That's one thing I haven't seen.
Cemetery, there is no cemetery. The only person that I know that's buried in this area was a young woman, I forget their names. He worked up here, the family was here, they were here for a number of years, and he later was the ski operator at Stevens Pass and is at one of the passes now. But she died, I think, soon after childbirth, and because they'd spent a lot of time up at Lyman Lake, her body was cremated and the ashes were taken up to Lyman Lake, and I haven't seen it. I've talked to people who have seen it, but there's supposedly a brass plate on one of the rocks up there that really is, and as far as I know, that's the only person that's ever been buried up here. A number of years ago, we did look into the rules and regulations of, you know, could we have a cemetery up here? there's very few regulations in the state. You have to go through the health department, I think, get a permit. But, you know, there are certain regulations that you can't have a cemetery within so many feet of a river or lake and, you know, things like this. But outside of that, there would be no reason why we couldn't have a cemetery up here. But I guess I'm not sure why we would want a cemetery up here.
That is not the village.
No, the mine. No, any deaths that occurred in the mine, people were taken down lake and buried in probably their home cemetery. So, yes.
What is the story of all the miners' cabins that don't exist anymore?
Well, that area down there was known as Winston Camp, and Winston there was, I think, a Winston Construction Company that came in here to do some of the original mine work, exploration work, and construction work, and that's where the name Winston came from, Winston Camp. And this village was basically the professional people had the chalets, the mine engineers, the accountants, the professional people that worked in the mine. The lodges that we use now were used by single people that worked in the mines that, you know, didn't want to buy a house or build a house in Winston Camp. And so Winston Camp was exclusively for families that came and worked in the mine. In the initial years, I think for the first year or two, it was strictly a male population up here. The mine, I guess, had made the decision that they, I guess, didn't want women. And but it became evident soon after that that they couldn't get enough men if wives weren't allowed to come. And so I don't know exactly, but I think it was after just a couple of years that they changed that, so wives started coming in, or maybe it's even earlier than that, maybe, because I do know some people that were here in 37, which is the first year, lived up on Honeymoon Heights. And but there were about 100 homes down in Winston Camp, and they were on three tiers. From the upper mine level, you can still see the three levels of the homes. And some of them were very nice homes. They were built by the miners themselves, so they weren't built as well as these buildings. And they deteriorated much more quickly. So that in 1957, when the mine closed down, people actually owned and held title to them. Some of the buildings were given to Holden. Some people actually took them apart, and the mine hauled them down lake free of charge for them if people wanted to take them out and rebuild them someplace. A lot of people just took out, like, door jams and window jams and things that they might need and would be more costly to buy if they built their own home, you know, down lake. But most of the homes were left here. And then after 3 years, the ownership really reverted back to the Forest Service. And then because of the fire potential, just the liability and danger problems, there was no option but to burn down the homes. The village had the opportunity to go in and salvage as much material out of that village, out of those 100 homes, as we could. But in those years, there were so few workers available just to do the mammoth task that was needed here that there was no chance to do anything down there. So it was, I think, around Thanksgiving or in the fall of 1963 that the Forest Service came in and torched off the village, and it was after the first good snow that occurred, so that there would be minimal danger of the fire spreading, and all the homes were burned down. And then about 10, 12 years ago, the Forest Service had some money for some cleanup work and came in and pretty well dozed over the foundations in the first two levels, but ran out of money before they could complete the dozing of the foundations on the third level. So if you walk up in that area, there are still three or four or five foundations left from the original homes on the highest or the third level. And the ski area for the village was, for the area was just to the west and up on Martin's Ridge in back of the village. If you go up there, you probably still see where some of the standards were from the rope tow. It was taken out by an avalanche at some point and never reestablished. So,
the old engine's still up there.
Yeah, the old engine was still there. And I think a couple of years ago, or a number of years ago, we talked about putting in a rope tow down here, and we brought the old Model A wheels that they used for the reels for the rope tows. And I think it was a Model A that had the inside groove was just the right size for a rope to go into it. And a lot of the early ski lifts used those for, now they've gotten a little fancier, but that's what they used up here. Some other questions that we're not very far in the history, but get what?
This building on the roof.
How they build it? Well, this building was one of the lodges, like the lodges 2, 3, and 4 that you're living in, and we never did understand why the mine started dismantling this building, but when we got here, all of the wallboard, all the plumbing had been taken out, but it was still a two-floor lodge, just like all the other lodges were. In 1963, it was a very cold summer, a cold, wet summer, and it became evident that year that there was just no place for village, for people to warm up, you know, like a hotel lobby, a public place where people could feel free to come in and gather around a fireplace and just warm up. There was no heat in any of the buildings in 63. The first heat was really in 1964. Most of the time from 61, 62, 63, there was no hot water in any of the buildings. The hotel was the only building that had hot water, and that was primarily for the kitchen. So that summer, you know, we thought that we'd need some place where people can just gather around, both as a program place and also as a place to enjoy and warm up. And the ALC Youth Board was having a national conference out here in August of that year, and the wife of an architect, Willis Shelbert from Forest City, Iowa, the wife was on the board, the husband came along to babysit, but when he found out he was an architect, we asked him to take a look at this building and gave him some measurements, and he went home and came up with three different styles of building that he thought we might consider. And so Willis Shelbert did the architecture work on a volunteer basis, and he came up with the three different plans primarily revolved around different fireplace schemes. One of them had a big rock fireplace against that wall with the chimney going up, which we had to eliminate because of the snow sliding off the roofs would take the chimney out. The other one was right back there where the fire panel is. There was going to be a big floor-to-ceiling rock fireplace there, which we actually chose. And I went back to Forest City in January or February of 1964, you know, telling him that this is the one we were going to choose and that we were making plans. And he says, well, if you want to go that way, that's fine, but I'm not going to, you know, continue doing the work for you because I don't think that that's, you know, what's going to work out for you. He said, from what you told me you wanted to do with that building, he said, if you put a fireplace back there, you're going to have rows of chairs lined up just like a church or a meeting hall, and it's, you know, you're not going to accomplish the purpose. So he said this particular design here was the one that he would work on, and he would volunteer his time to do this one, and we said, fine, that's the one we decided on. I don't think we've regretted it, so. But the building did get started at that time. The first half was completed in 1966, and the back half was done the next year, and has been one of our main winter buildings. The new addition was just added on this last year, so some of you that haven't been here before, Koinonia was just this section, and the new section was just added on a year ago. Some more questions that on any particular points of just here. Oh, wait until afterwards, and I can talk to you.
You said you had two fires here. What happened then?
In 1969, Chalet 2 burned down, which the foundation is still there. We've always thought about rebuilding it, so we haven't excavated or done away with the foundation. We don't know exactly what happened. It was in January, probably the wood stove, and it occurred, actually, this building was being used. Everybody was over here. The fire wasn't discovered until sometime like 1 or 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and by that time, the building was really engulfed in flames, and there was nothing left to save. The only thing left to do was to protect some of the other buildings. Fortunately, the amount of snow that's on the ground and on the buildings at that time of year, is sufficient to provide insulation and safety. The only thing that we could do would be to spray like the side of Chalet 3, and that could have started a chain reaction. And if we wouldn't have been able to use water on that chalet, Chalet 3 probably would have burned. And that's always our fear up here, that, you know, because the buildings are this close together and you get a good fire going, that, you know, the whole village can be wiped out in a very short time. So fortunately, that no other buildings were damaged. Chalet 2 burned down. To show the effects of how snow can insulate, maybe you've noticed back to where the salt lake is, there's a little weather bureau building, which we have the high and low temperature, and we send that in. Well, on that particular day, the high temperature was 19 degrees. And that's that close to the building, but there was the snow had come off the roof, you know, over the period of the winter, and there was a big mound of snow between the weather shelter, and but that's only like, 10 feet, 15 feet, and it didn't even, you know, exceed 19 degrees at that point, so the snow is really a good insulator, so. Oh yeah, and then the other fire that we had was in 1977, which was the garage, which was the former maintenance building of the mine, and that probably was a welding fire that occurred in the afternoon. It was a very small, insignificant fire that they thought was out, and apparently it wasn't, and about, 9 o'clock in the evening, it was discovered. Again, it was pretty well gone by that time. There was nothing really left to do but to take pictures and try to keep the buses from burning up that were sitting out. Fortunately, we did lose a couple vehicles that were in the garage, but they weren't any of our major vehicles, or our snowmobiles weren't burned up. But that, I think, is an example of what happened after that, of how the village has really kept going, and why I think that the village can keep going. We, of course, knew that we needed some kind of a maintenance building because the winter was coming. This was the first part of November. I think the third or fourth of November it burned. And already there was snow on the ground, and there was no way that we could get through the winter without some type of a maintenance building. We contacted a couple of friends in Ocean Shores. That one was a contractor, and another one was on our science committee. And I called them and said, you know, what's the quickest building we can put up, and can you give us a hand? Can you find a crew and see what we can do? And they thought about it for a very short time and said, well, an A-frame would be easy, because you can go out in the woods and cut your poles, and all you need is some galvanized corrugated to put over the poles, and in a short time you can have your building. And so they came up, they made a jig so we could cut the right angles on the poles, and they gave us a hand for, I think, 3 or 4 days getting it started. And I think within 20 days we had the garage, the first section of the garage, enough for us to exist on for that winter, up and covered. And it was some miserable weather that we worked in, but within that short of time, from 20 days after the fire, that we had the new garage really intact and usable. And over the period of the history of the village, I think this has been the significant thing, that the people that are willing to volunteer their time, not only to operate the village during the summer, as many of them are right now, but the people who give us advice, who come up here as paying guests and end up, you know, helping with the project. It's always interesting that if we could do all of our projects in the center of the village, we would get them done much quicker. Because like when we were doing the jacuzzi, a couple of years ago, we had to dig up the cement pad around it because we had some leaks in the pipes. And we rented an electric jackhammer, and of course that makes enough noise and it's close enough into the village. And there was a group here from Sacramento, California, and the Mavericks were up there and getting started, and about 5 minutes after the Mavericks started doing it, about 10 of these people from Sacramento came up and proceeded to work the whole rest of the week and finished the project off, you know. And it was, you know, we almost had to set up a schedule to so that they didn't get over into fights on who was going to run the jackhammer. But the same way with anything we do. When we were working on Koinonia, the same thing. We have a science and technology committee that are people in the engineering and science fields that volunteer their time. And these are people, many of you know, like Leo Busted, who's the dean of veterinary medicine at Washington State University. He chairs this committee. And these are people that literally, and it still amazes me that, you know, Leo can call somebody, whether it's on the East or West Coast or in Europe, if we're working on a project, and, you know, get the information that we need that isn't accessible to a lot of universities, literally, and or make contacts with people who are interested in what we're doing on the tailings, or interested in solar, or, you know, whatever it might be. And Dave Dorn, who's on the committees with the Lawrence Labs in Livermore, California, and doing a lot of work in the photovoltaic area of solar, and was up last year, and keeps us abreast of those types of things. They're just, it's just amazing. The village has really been blessed by people that are willing to do these things. I mean, they might work, you know, 40 hours a week at home doing these things, and yet they come up here and they're excited to help out. Or they go back and they keep working on projects for us when they're not up here. Volunteer architects or engineers or whatever it might be. And I guess this is one of the things that's exciting about any community. A congregation runs into the same thing. Sometimes maybe not as dramatic as what happens up here, but you still have a basic community that's held together by volunteers. And it's exciting. I think this is why the village, you know, is exciting for people to come to, because really every person that comes here changes the community. And this week, this community is, you know, has one flavor, because you're here and you're contributing to it. You're a part of it. You're not coming here to be entertained. If you are, then you don't understand what the village is all about. When you come here, you may register and pay, but I guess the way I like to look at it is that you're paying to come here as a guest because you don't have enough time to work here. And I think this is the case with most people, that if they had the choice, they would rather come for 3 weeks, which is our minimum for working, but many people don't have that option. So we have the category of a guest, which means that you come here for a week or whatever, and you pay for registration, and then you're a part of the community. But you're no less a part of the community, or the staff is no more of a part of the community than anybody else. And again, this is the quicker you feel this and pick this up, the more you will understand the village, and the more that you will be excited by the village.
How can you do it at such a low cost?
Well, because people subsidize it. When you come and pay the $125, well, now it's less than that. I think we're still in the sort of the pre-summer period, so it's, I think, only $90 a week through the rest of this week. But the normal registration rate is $125. At that rate, even the $125 rate, you're paying for about 80% of the cost of the operation of the village. So everybody that comes here is subsidized, and you're subsidized by basically a few people who are making contributions to the village throughout the year. And I think it's, again, one of the blessings that the village has experienced is that we've been able to stay alive, again, through many hours of volunteer labor, through the gifts of basically a very few of the total people that use the village. Like last year, out of the 5,500 people that were here, we only received, I think it was just slightly over 800 gifts out of the total of 70,000 people that have actually registered at the village over the 20 years or 21 years period. Now, not all of those are new, but still last year only 820 people sent in gifts to the village. Well, that was enough to keep us alive, so we don't have any major fundraising drive. In other words, the village has had the philosophy that we'll do some of these projects when we have the money. When we don't have the money, we hold back. I guess it's been operated sort of like a family, you know, would operate. Even though we see the potential of raising large sums of money, and some people have actually suggested this, and some people have sat on our board and say, well, you've got a gold mine, that with the potential that you have for raising money, we could start a fundraising program and you could raise $1 million like nothing. Professional fundraisers have told us. And we've said, well, you know, why do we want to raise $1 million? You know, we paid last year's bills. You know, we anticipate that we'll pay next year's bills. And the board actually voted 2 years ago that we wouldn't even keep a contingency fund for, like, fire insurance. The village has no fire insurance. It's available to us. We've had some companies anxious to. In fact, the Frank B. Hall Company, which is an international insurance company, has all of our other insurance, and they wanted to have fire insurance on the village and then put out a special brochure that said that the Frank B. Hall Company has the total insurance in this one town in the United States. And it would have just been a promotional thing for them, but we figured that we could lose a building every 10 years and come out ahead as far as insurance is concerned, so we don't carry insurance. Well, the board decided that we would keep $3,000 in our contingency fund for fire insurance. And the reason for the $3,000 figure is that's about what it costs us to put out two mailings. And the example, or really why we did that, is that when the garage burned down, we send out one mailing, and just indicated that the garage had burned down, that we anticipated that about $20,000 would be needed to, you know, reconstruct the building, and most of that $20,000 would be needed for equipment. The building was very inexpensive. And I think in a couple months, we had $25,000 or $28,000. And so that, you know, it became evident that the village, you know, didn't want to build up its coffers just because we could, you know, and some organizations do this. They have the ability to raise a lot of funds and they just keep doing it, and it ends up usually, you know, it's easy then, if you have the money, to spend it on things you really don't need. And we've tried to keep within our budget and spend the money that we need, but, you know, not have a large fundraising projects if we don't need them. And as I said before, the village has never had to borrow money. If we build a hydro plant, we may need to borrow money, or we may need to have a larger fundraising drive, but that's in the future, and that's not with us yet. Sorry we didn't get far, but that's...